Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we try to find you the greatest little tidbits of music history on the internet, just so you can have something to listen to and enjoy on this podcast known as Follow the Sound. Along with me is my co-host, Jacob Crum.
Greetings. Good evening.
And Greg Harvey is once again out working for the money. If you listen to last week's episode, you will understand that I did the same joke twice. But that's beside the point. I'm kind of goofy when it comes to jokes. I'm not very good at them. I'm sorry. That's why I brought Jake on, because Jake is more of a comedian than me. But if you like our show and you want to listen to other shows, you can go to lineupmedia.fm, click on any of the programs that are on there, whatever suits your fancy, and enjoy. Listen to those other shows. We encourage you to listen to other shows. We're not being like, oh, if you listen to our show, you can't listen to anything else. Go out there. Find these other programs that you enjoy. Just, you know, keep coming back and listening to our show, too, because we need you to listen to us. Because without you, we are just two guys sitting in a room talking into microphones for no reason.
Which we would also do.
Which we would probably also do. Because, you know, there's going to be at least five of you that actually do listen to this. Right. Just because I know a couple of our friends are subscribed to the podcast, so we got those people.
But if we didn't have listeners, Brian, I would not be doing any research whatsoever and just be making up stories. What happened today? 1971, Harris and Gumbel wrote a show tune.
Yes. So also, if you want to help support the show, you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com and click on the Amazon banner on the right hand side. Or you can type in followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. It takes you to Amazon. You can do all your normal shopping. But as long as you buy something, we get a little bit of money back, a little bit of a percentage of whatever it is that you buy. And it helps us continue on. And we are doing quite well as far as the Amazon stuff goes, because I know you guys are out there actually purchasing stuff, and that is good. Continue to do so. Continue to help support this podcast, and it doesn't make me rich, all right? This isn't money going straight to my pocket. This is just going to help with production costs and like that kind of stuff. So it just makes it a lot easier for us. But thank you to those who have shopped on Amazon using our link. And we hope that other people who listen will actually go on there and do that for us as well. But Jake.
Yes.
Got ourselves a good week this week.
Mm-hmm.
We have July 24th through July 28th. And I think we got some good stuff this week. Do you care to elaborate?
I do care to elaborate.
What do we got?
Let's start with July 24th. How's that sound? Chronological order is the logical order to begin in. So in 1956, 10 years to the day, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis call it quits and play their final show at the Copacabana.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you see, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, classic team up of the straight guy versus the funny man.
Not so classic if you're looking at vaudeville, because usually the straight man was also the MC.
Yes, that is true.
Vaudeville, and then they would have a bunch of different stooges that would come around and make jokes. So,
but the straight man in comedy was always the harder gig,
because
they were rarer in one,
yes.
And then the other part was that you know, anybody could be goofy. Anybody could be the clown.
Right.
But to be that man who doesn't laugh, like,
yes,
that's a hard,
yes,
thing.
Yes.
So that's why, you know, you've got like Abbott and Costello, which is one of the great teams of comedy and straight man. But Martin and Lewis, similar kind of thing. It's just that one of them happened to be, you know, a raging alcoholic and the other one was a clown.
And also a really conceited guy. Have you ever heard Jerry Lewis talk about himself?
Both of them,
well, yeah,
Martin and Lewis,
that's
both
true.
Of them, like, just, they were really over the top, like into themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, I don't get it. Like, I mean, I know they're funny. I know they had some really good stuff. But at the same time, man, like, Jerry Lewis just does not, I've never really found Jerry Lewis to be funny.
Really?
Like, it's not, okay, it's not that I don't find what he does amusing, but he just, like, it's never been that, you know, like just laughter, just,
yeah,
you know, where my stomach hurts from laughing at it.
I mean, you've watched.
I've always needed like more mental stuff, you know, like the smarter jokes. So
you've watched all the, you know, classic Jerry Lewis movies, like Who's Minding the Store? And
yes, yeah.
the typewriter bit is, it's really good. I think that's really funny.
Yeah.
The thing that kills me about Jerry Lewis is a lot of people say, well, there's only one Jerry Lewis. And I disagree because he took his shtick from the Ritz Brothers.
Yeah.
And there's three Jerry Lewis's for you right there.
Mm-hmm.
All three Ritz Brothers. You just, nobody talks about them because people aren't re-releasing Greta Garbo movies. You know, like the Ritz Brothers didn't have their own movies. They were the comic relief in other people's movies from MGM.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they did a lot of dance numbers and just songs.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Yeah, but let's move on. 1968. You can absolutely do this one, too.
I know. 1968, Jimmy Drake, the man who would later be better known as Nervous Norvis, finally drinks himself to death and succumbs to cirrhosis of the liver at age 56. Now, we've talked about him on the show before, and I got many of my facts wrong. So I'm planning, maybe, I'm going to hint, I'll say it right now. I'm going to do a slight deep dive, maybe like a 15-minute episode, just talking about Nervous Norvis.
I suggest that you do that.
Yes, and because, we'll get all the facts right.
Because I would love that.
Yes, to talk about him, you have to talk about a man named Red Blanchard, who was a radio show host in the 50s and the late 40s in Southern California. And you have to tell his story, too, so that you understand where Nervous Norvis came from.
Mm-hmm.
The man who hit number one in Billboard, had the most popular song in the U.S. with Transfusion, the exact same recording that he recorded in his kitchen.
Nice.
On a reel-to-reel machine that he bought for like $4. And there you go. So Transfusion was a single about a man who gets addicted to transfusions and keeps getting in automobile accidents to get them.
Mm.
It was actually censored and banned on several radio stations.
Yeah.
Which is like the most ridiculous thing. Like, really, who's going to protect the children from these rampant transfusion addicts? Anyway, so that's poor Jimmy Drake.
All right. So
Yes. Here's
the thing I know about this particular day as far as our notes go.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these are yours.
Yes, they are.
Because I didn't really find much on this mm-hmm. date that I actually wanted to talk about. But you're going to have to do the next one, too.
That's fine.
Go ahead.
Yeah. This is a really another just crazy bizarre death that we've had in the last couple of weeks now. So 1972.
You are a fan of bizarre deaths.
I when they're weird, man, and they stick with me.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1972, Bobby Ramirez, the drummer, Edgar Winter's drummer from Edgar Winter's White Trash, is stomped to death outside of a bar by a patron of the bar. According to Edgar Winter's manager and a couple other band members, they'd gone there to just have a couple drinks to celebrate, and Bobby Ramirez walked into the bathroom, and somebody made a comment about, like, hey, shouldn't you be in the other bathroom with that long hair of yours? And Bobby Ramirez got in his face and then got knocked out in the bathroom.
Mm.
Bobby Ramirez went to the bar owner, wanted him to call the police. The bar owner refused to do so. So he followed the guy that just kicked his ass out into the parking lot, where fortunately the guy apparently was an iron worker because he's wearing metatarsal boots, and kicked him to death.
Wow.
And beat up at least one or two of his other band members. And they woke up to see Bobby Ramirez bleeding to death in the arms of his manager.
Wow.
So heavy.
Yeah. What happened to the guy who killed him?
I guess he probably started drinking at another bar, because as far as the sources I had, nothing ever came of it.
Mm, interesting. All right. So now I got one.
All right.
All right. 1978. Robert Stigwood.
Yes.
Now, a lot of people may not know who Robert Stigwood is, but Robert Stigwood was a director. And he released the film Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club
Band.
Never
heard of it.
Which, of course, was made extremely famous by the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best albums they ever made. Brilliant album. And just great. So he released this movie.
Yes.
featuring not the Beatles.
No.
In the lead singing Beatles songs, but in fact, the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton.
Peter Frampton.
The film was, it received extremely negative reviews from most critics, and it barely broke even at the box office, which means that that movie could not have cost that much to make in the first place. But it just cracks me up that somebody was like, I'm going to make a movie, and I'm going to call it Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And in the movie, they're going to do Beatles songs from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, but it's not going to have the Beatles in it. And some producer was just like, yeah, let's do that.
We can't go wrong.
There was a studio that was just like, this is going to be brilliant. Who do you want to be in it? Well, I got these guys, the Bee Gees. Like, they're huge. They're going to be huge. You know, and I got this other dude, Peter Frampton. Let's put those guys in it instead of the Beatles. Okay.
Well, in 1978, it kind of probably would have been hard to get the Beatles to do the movie, right?
Well, yes, but at the same time, it was just like they could have done something. I mean, look at Yellow Submarine. It's freaking animated. Right. Like, they could have done something. But now they're like, yeah, we're going to have the Bee Gees do this. So there you go. It's widely regarded as one of the worst movies like ever made.
Yeah. It can't be worse than Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park.
It can't be worse than The Room, but that's beside the point.
Or Ator the Fighting Eagle.
Or Outlaw of Gore.
I love Outlaw of Gore so much.
Jake and I are big fans of like really bad fantasy movies, and Outlaw of Gore is just one of the creme de la cremes.
From the completely abandoned sword and planet genre.
Yes.
Anyway, we should... That's for another podcast. Honestly.
Quest for the Mighty Sword.
Grendel! All right. So speaking of movies.
Yes. Another great movie.
Actually, a good movie. 1987, La Bamba, starring Lou Diamond Phillips as Richie Valens debuts.
Which is great, because Lou Diamond Phillips was, like, is not Hispanic.
Yeah.
But
you know what?
He looks like it, so...
I don't know about that, but he did his own vocals.
He nailed the part.
He did.
He really did nail that part. And what I loved about La Bamba was the fact that, I mean, everybody remembers, you know, at least those of us who love music and love music history, everybody knows about the day the music died. You know, everybody knows about Buddy Holly dying. And maybe, you know, like a lot of people know about the Big Bopper, you know, because the Big Bopper was pretty huge too. It's like, but Richie Valens was like the lesser known of these guys. And Buddy Holly, with the Buddy Holly story, of course, like everybody knew about that. And Buddy Holly was like the real one that everybody was like, oh my God, like I can't believe he died. It's like, but Richie Valens, like, was really not getting, like, the respect that he deserved, in my opinion. And so I was so glad, like, that this movie gave him a piece of that, of, like, people actually being like, you know, oh, man, it's really sad that he actually was lost as well. But, I mean, because not only did he do, like, La Bamba, you know, as like, one of the great, like, Spanish rock songs, actually, which was really nice. But I mean, he had a bunch of other songs that were also just top notch songs for the era, and I'm super glad that this movie got made, this biopic got made about him, because he really did deserve it.
I'm still waiting on that Big Bopper biopic.
That's going to be a bit harder to do, I think.
Yeah,
just because he really only had like the one hit. Mm-hmm. Like there was nothing really like truly unique about him.
It's not that. It's that
Chantilly lace and a pretty face and a ponytail hanging down.
No, it's more that. Okay, you ready for this, Brian? In a post Warhol era, where image is so important, the Big Bopper doesn't really have like a silhouette that everybody can look at and just recognize.
Well, that's kind of the funny thing is that Lou Diamond Phillips was probably about 30 pounds lighter than Richie Valens. Yeah. But I mean, Richie was definitely like just a cool cat.
Yeah.
I mean, I really enjoy his vocals. He was very good. Mm-hmm. Like he had just great vocals for that era.
Also, we should probably mention that the film isn't that accurate as far
no,
as
it's not accurate,
goes.
But
it's but you know, hey, it's actually it's a good movie.
It is
it's
a very
just as a watch.
Yes, so I'm looking at Richie Valens, and it's definitely like Lou Diamond Phillips was just way like way skinnier than him. But here's the thing too. I mean, Richie Valens died at the age of 17.
Yeah. Think you about know? That.
So I mean, he was quite young with that. So I mean, and he so there you go. I mean, he obviously like accomplished quite a bit in a very short period of time to be able to be established like that. So I'm happy that it was made. It was a good one. Apparently, he's popped up in. I mean, obviously he's been represented in other movies.
Yeah,
but he was having a biopic made about somebody as opposed to just being in somebody else's movie.
Yeah.
Two very different things. But and Lou Diamond Phillips, of course, that like really put him on the map as far as being an actor goes. But yeah, I'm just trying to look at. Okay, so I mean, he actually did it looks like three different albums in total. He's had Richie Valens, then just Richie, and then Richie Valens in concert at Pacoima Junior High. So he did it in 59, 59, and 1960. Pretty wild, man. Pretty wild. I like it. All right, moving on.
Yes, here we go. 1999. Wedding bells ring for quite possibly the only all-rapper wedding. When Reverend Run weds Treach and Peppa.
From Salt and Pepper?
From Salt and Pepper. And Treach from Naughty by Nature. And, of course, Reverend Run from Run DMC.
Yes.
In a what was a really star-studded
Whose
wedding
house?
At the time.
Yes, star-studded wedding.
Yeah, like everybody was there. I remember Queen Latifah particularly coming out and talking to the media.
Now, here's my question then. Are they still married?
No, they separated 4 years later, and young Miss Peppa I don't remember. There were abuse charges. It was pretty messy.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, that's going to happen.
That's the
sometimes.
Way love goes.
I know later on, I know we're going to talk about somebody else who was also in an abusive relationship. But before we get there, on this day in July 24th, 2014, Jake.
Yes.
You can take this last one, too.
You don't want this one. I thought you would have loved it.
Go for it. You can say
right.
it. Because I'm the one who maintains the semblance of respectability on this podcast.
You definitely are. You did not bring me for respectability. You've already said
no,
so.
No, I did definitely did not. I brought you in for comedy, and this is exactly that. So
all
go
right.
ahead and
well,
give it to me.
Well, in 2014, Hewlett-Packard and Chubby Checker subtle.
Didn't he die?
No. In fact, he was filing lawsuits just 3 years ago.
He's very much still alive.
Very still much checkering. They settled a lawsuit filed by Chubby over Hewlett-Packard's app called the Chubby Checker, which estimated the size of a man's unit based on his shoe size.
Wow.
Really terrible idea. Somebody pitched because they had nothing else. They didn't prepare for any meeting. Just came in and just said, how about the Chubby Checker? Okay, what's it do? Cock size, shoe size. And they went, well, you got nothing else.
That sounds like somebody would, like, you ever watch the show Silicon Valley?
No.
Well, you need to.
I need to.
But one of the things that makes that show really funny is that there's all of these other people that are in like other startups in Silicon Valley.
Yes.
And they keep pitching all of this just completely stupid crap of like dumb little apps that do completely pointless things, and yet they're all super excited about. That's what this reminds me of. Like, that's why when somebody was like, when I read the whole thing with about an app called the Chubby Checker,
yes,
and it was like somebody actually legitimately pitched this and it got made.
Yes,
crazy talk.
I know it. You can't make up some things.
No,
just actually happened.
You cannot. Let's move on to July 25th though. Let's start off with one of my favorite rock icons from the 60s. In 1960, Roy Orbison reached number two on the U.S. single charts with Only the Lonely, ooh, which is an amazing song. But it was his first hit, and the song was actually turned down by the Everly Brothers and Elvis Presley. So Orbison decided to record the song himself, which was great.
Yes.
Because only Roy Orbison could really sing that song.
I agree. That's a song that comes on that I don't sing along to.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, I don't even try.
It's hard to sing along with Roy Orbison songs.
Yeah.
I mean, but everything that he did was just this great sort of Southern operatic kind of sound.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and he could hit these super high notes and then just drop down to like these low tones. Like, I mean, the man's voice was incredible. And, you know, I can understand if somebody would be like, well, I don't really care for Roy Orbison, but you can not care for him or his music, but you cannot deny that the man was an incredible talent.
Yes. Yeah.
I still, Only the Lonely, I mean, is such a great song. In Dreams is just brilliant. Like, I think everybody knows Pretty Woman, obviously, but Pretty Woman to me is like actually one of the weaker songs of his repertoire. But at the same time, I mean, it was like his most famous song and, you know, like put him over the top. But man, like Only the Lonely is like, Only the Lonely know the way I feel tonight. Like, that's a great line.
Mm-hmm.
Like, love it. And then, of course, they made that movie, Only the Lonely, which starred John Candy.
Yes. Yeah. Was that the one where he was a cop who was dating a makeup artist for a funeral home?
Yeah, it was something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of those like comedy dramas that they made back in like the 80s. I need to watch that movie again now. Great.
Yeah, they sit down. I believe the movie peak says they're sitting down having a picnic in Wrigley Field.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I remember that. All right, so moving on to 1964, the Beatles' third album, A Hard Day's Night, started a 21 week run at the top of the UK charts. This was the first Beatles album to be recorded entirely on 4-track tape, allowing for good stereo mixes.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what I really love about the Hard Day's Night soundtrack is on the title track, Hard Day's Night, that one chord in the very beginning of the song.
Okay.
That it's just, it's a whong, like, and it's, It takes like four guitars to actually recreate that sound. Like, that's how unique of a sound it actually was. So I love that. To me, Hard Day's Night is actually like the best of the original Beatles stuff, or the original sound of the Beatles. The Hard Day's Night is just the best one.
There's a documentary series on Netflix that you kind of just reminded me of, where they sit down with producers and have them take the original masters and then remix them on a board and talk about the recording process.
What show is this?
I can't remember. It's a series of documentaries, and I watched them.
It's not Soundbreaking, is it? Because that was the one I was talking about a few weeks ago.
Maybe. I don't know.
If you go home and you find out whatever it was, and then I'll let me know.
Because I watched one that, where they did a Cream album. And it was really great to go.
Oh, are you talking about I know what you're talking about, actually. Let me look.
But it's not just the Cream documentary that's on there. There's several of these, and they all go under kind of the same title. But
yeah, I think I know what you're talking about. Was the TV series called Classic Albums?
Yes, there you go.
Okay, yeah, so
how hard that was.
I have some of these at home. I've got a couple of these episodes, but I remember, like, actually it was one of the first shows that I remember watching, because I started watching it when I was in college,
mm-hmm.
and really like just loving everything that they did. So they've got so many just great episodes for great albums on and it really, it completely broadened my horizon for other albums.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why I'm a fan of Phil Collins' Face Value.
Yeah.
It's the entire reason as to why I got Paul Simon's Graceland, the band's self-titled album. I mean, like, they break down U2's Joshua Tree album, mm-hmm. like, just so many good ones.
Yeah, I love listening to the engineers go, okay, so this is what Clapton's Cream guitar sounds like. It's a Stratocaster played through these Marshall stacks with orange heads, and it's doubled, so it's stereo, and here you go.
Yes.
And then you're like, oh, and then the engineer might say, oh, I tried something kind of like this on a previous album, and he'll name another band that you've never heard of. And then you have to go and listen to him, and then you go, oh my God, that sounds just like Eric Clapton's guitar work.
Yes.
It's like, it's the exact same sound. He's playing different, but.
Yeah. Anyway. No. Classic albums, one of the best documentary series I've ever come across.
I'm kicking myself for it. Like, how do you not remember just the title, Classic Albums?
Well, I had to look it up because I was like, you know, and it finally triggered in my head. So, but yes, Classic Albums. Yeah. Great.
We have
great
more stories, though.
Yes. You can do the next one. 1965.
Okay. I'll just say it and you can talk about it. 1965, Dylan plugs in.
Once again, Dylan goes electric.
Yes.
We've all discussed this before. The reason Dylan went electric is because John Lennon told him to. The reason John Lennon started getting all political was because Bob Dylan told him to. And thus, the world was changed.
Or just some good music came out of it.
Yes. So Dylan, of course, going electric was a huge, huge deal for the folk fans of the era.
Yes.
A lot of the people who were in Greenwich Village, of which I've been to Greenwich Village in New York. It is still that way. Like, it is still just full of artists who are trying to just create their art and do it in New York. So I loved it actually when I was there. That was the when I was in New York, I was like, wow, this city's huge and everything. And then when we went to Greenwich Village, I was like, these are my people. It's like, I feel it here. You know, I felt that sort of New York essence that everybody talks about. But Dylan going electric was a very big deal. And I mean, obviously we got a lot of really good music out of it, but at the time, a lot of people did not like it.
No.
So, there you go. But speaking of more good music, 1969, Neil Young appeared with Crosby, Stills, and Nash for the first time when he played at the Fillmore East in New York. Young was initially asked just to help out with live material only, but ended up joining the group on and off for the next 30 years, which is why they then became known as Crosby, Stills, Nash, and sometimes Young.
And sometimes why?
Yes, I've always been a fan of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And, of course, like, they, I mean, their first gig ever was Woodstock. So, you know, there's that. But then when they added in Neil Young with his high voice, like, at that time, you know, Neil Young had this really good high voice. Just, it mixed so well. It's like, the three of them together were fantastic. The four of them together, it was like, oh, my.
Like, there was that nuftet sound.
Yes, nuftet. Nice Mighty Wind reference. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, good stuff. But yeah, fantastic just listening to those four guys sing together. And I think we should move on to the next one, though, because I got nothing else to add.
Oh, okay. I like Neil Young. Anyway, 1970, Mungo Jerry's first single, In the Summertime, hits airwaves.
In the summertime,
when the weather is fine, you can stride up and touch the sky. No, when the weather is hot, when the weather is fine, you got women on your mind. Yeah.
I don't know why. For some reason, I always thought that was like a Turtles song.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know why.
I don't either.
Weird.
Does not bring the Turtles to mind for me.
I don't know.
But that's like
Lovin' Spoonfuls. So, I mean, because they kind of had like some weirder sounds like that.
Yeah.
So, but that's great. I like that song quite a bit, actually.
Yeah.
It's been played a lot in movies. I know that.
Yes, it has. Which makes me think that the like licensing fee for it is just like dirt cheap.
Yeah. It's like generally if you're going to be like playing any, any song that involves like summer, it's like they like to play, you know, in the summertime. Maybe they'll play Cruel Summer if it's that kind of movie.
Yes.
But yeah, no, it's one of those go-to songs for like fun in the summer.
Yes.
Back in the day when everything was good and all the suburbs were white.
Nostalgia, nostalgia, nostalgia.
Yes, it's just... All right, let's move on. 1975. Yeah, you can take this one, too.
Yeah, we've briefly talked about this before, and at some point, we've got to actually both go... We have to sit down together and watch A Chorus Line, because in 1975...
Yeah,
because
I've never seen it.
Right. A Chorus Line opens on Broadway, became the longest-running show, ran for 15 years, tallies over 9,000 shows.
This, of course, would be trumped by Cats later on.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember the Cats sketch from Saturday Night Live?
No.
Oh, I think it's... No, it's not Neil Patrick Harris. It's the guy from Dawson's Creek.
Oh, I don't know. You're gonna have to, I'm going to have to look one up.
So Cats becomes the longest running show, both in years and in number of shows. Mm-hmm. And they did this sketch where like Chris Kattan comes out and he's like talking directly into the camera, introducing everyone to the backstage of Cats.
Yes, I remember that.
Right, and what's his face from Dawson's Creek is the protagonist of the Cats show. I can't remember his name, Mr. Mittens or something.
I do not recall.
Anyway, it's
I can look it up
such,
if you want.
It's such a great sketch. Oh my god! And everyone backstage is just beaten down by life and smoking cigarettes and just drinking to get through the day because they have to spend their job is as adults to dress up as cats and sing songs. And when you think about it in those terms, it sounds like just an absolute nightmarish scenario.
Man, it's like, man, I'm looking at the stuff for Cats, and this is just cracking me up. Like, just the sheer amount of stuff that they ended up doing for this. The Jellicle Cats! Oh, man. Good stuff here either way. I have seen Cats once. I saw it on like, a DVD, because they had, like, the show, and I think... I don't remember most of it, which is really sad because I remember most things that like I see, but...
You used to torture me by singing that magical Mr. Mistopheles song.
I can't even recall how it goes right now.
Have you ever seen a cat so clever as magical Mr. Mistopheles? Anyway.
Wow.
I don't remember the melody of it, but that's the only line.
Well, there you go. Andrew Lloyd Webber, of course, you know, doing that one, but I've never been a huge fan of his anyway.
So. Either way, we've devoted too much time to something we haven't even seen.
That is true. All right, 1980, AC/DC releases their sixth internationally released studio album, Back in Black. It was the first AC/DC album recorded without former lead singer Bon Scott, who died on the 19th of February in 1980. At the age of 33. The album sold an estimated 49 million copies worldwide to date, making it the second highest selling album of all time. And it is the best selling hard rock or heavy metal album.
That's saying something, I guess.
That is certainly saying something. I mean, Back in Black is one of those albums that has like all of the hits that get played in like every movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And every arena constantly.
And also, Bon Scott was the guy that everybody talked about when they talked about AC/DC.
Yeah.
Like, they would be like, you know, Bon Scott, they'd have all these stories of him partying and doing crazy things.
Now, I've always thought that Bon Scott had a better voice.
Yes.
Than what it's Brian...
Something or other.
I'm blanking on his name right now, too. Once again, folks, yes, I know I'm horrible with names. If I don't have them written down, I generally don't remember them. But I always thought that Bon Scott had a better voice, and I always loved the original, like, AC/DC stuff. But Back in Black is a good album, so I like that stuff a lot. Now, here we go.
This is all yours.
1984. Now, this is one of those things that's near and dear to my heart. Willie Mae Big Mama Thornton died at the age of 58 in Los Angeles of heart and liver complications. She had a number one R&B hit in 1953 with the song Hound Dog, which was then later covered by Elvis. And but she also wrote and recorded Ball and Chain, which Janis Joplin later recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Janis Joplin, of course, you know, with Ball and Chain, she flat out gave props to Big Mama Thornton.
Yes.
Elvis did not. Because nobody wanted Elvis, everybody wanted Elvis to be like, well, he wrote these songs. You know, these are all songs that are like, they're Elvis's songs. And so they never like gave props to Big Mama Thornton.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go out there and ask anybody, you know, hey, who wrote and recorded Hound Dog? They'd be like, Elvis Presley. That's an Elvis Presley song. I'm like, no, it's Big Mama Thornton song. He just happened to cover it.
Yeah.
It's like, I think that she does not get as much respect as she deserves because, you know, of course, Hound Dog, when the way she wrote it, was a straight blues song. And even the line is slightly different because she goes, you ain't nothing but a hound dog been creeping around my door.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Instead of what Elvis did, which was you ain't nothing but a hound dog crying all the time. But it's just, it's one of those things where I get tired of everybody just being like, you know, well, Elvis did blah, 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 blah. It's like, I understand
Elvis invented
did.
Rock and roll. Oh,
like,
really?
No, he did not. But, you know, there's just a lot of those things. She's a character in history that needs to be more well known because she contributed drastically to what rock and roll became in obviously two different decades.
Yes.
So there you go. But you can take the last one, actually.
Yeah, here we go. Several weeks ago, we had talked about Studio 54, and we're like, did it close? When did it close? It closed, right? Well, 1989, co-owner of Studio 54, Stephen Rubell, died of AIDS-related illnesses at the age of 45. Very young man, very influential in the club scene, and New York probably wouldn't be the same New York. At least not the New York that came to be in the late 70s and early 80s.
Yes.
Without Studio 54 and Stephen Rubell.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the late 80s and early 90s, like, the AIDS epidemic was in full swing. And there was a lot of people who died.
Oh, yeah.
From that one. But, you know, it's just it's a sad thing. Very sad thing, because just a few years later, they finally came up with the cocktail that suppresses it, which is why Magic Johnson is still alive today. So,
yeah, there. And good thing. Thank you, science.
Yeah, so we lose Freddie Mercury, but hey, we still got Magic Johnson. Thanks, scientists.
You know what? That's a terrible cut on Magic Johnson. He's
saying.
He's a good guy.
We lost Mercury. And
well,
we still got all these other people. And then we got the musical Rent. Woo! Everyone has AIDS.
AIDS.
Oh, no, that's from Team America World Police. I'm sorry. All right, let's move on to July 26, 1943. Born on this day, Mick Jagger. I don't know. Who's that again? Oh, that's right. He's the lead singer of, like, the highest paid rock touring group of all time, the Rolling Stones.
You mean those guys that nobody remembers who in 1972 were attacked by a splinter group in Montreal?
Old skeletons, you know, just that get up there on stage and pretend to play music. That's not true. They do play music still. But in 1969, they had the number one single, Honky Tonk Woman. And they've, like, had over 35 top 40 singles and albums. They've done solo work with different things. They started their own label and did a bunch of other stuff. The Rolling Stones are influential in music for a lot of different reasons. So it's not necessarily just Mick Jagger, but, you know, they did a lot of stuff, and we... music would be vastly different had it not been for them.
Yes. We are forgetting, however, the Mick Jagger's role in the unforgivable single Dancing in the Street.
We can also not like Jagger for his association with the song Moves Like Jagger by Maroon 5.
Some things you should not be inspired.
Some things should not be done. But let's see. Also, born on this day in 1949, July 26th, Roger Taylor, the drummer for Queen.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he was the one who sang those high parts in, like, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody with that super, super high note.
Yeah, that
was all him. So I do know one thing, that after Taylor, after Freddie Mercury died,
yes,
Roger Taylor actually did like some of the vocal parts for their later recordings. But at the same time, I mean, Roger Taylor was not Freddie Mercury.
Right. So.
But he was actually a pretty good singer, and he was definitely a great drummer. So that's all that was needed.
Well, there you go.
That's all I got. That's it for that one. All right, moving on. I think I got another one here. Let's see. 1968, the Jackson 5 signed a one-year contract with Motown Records. They made history in 1970 as the first recording act to have their first four singles to reach number one on the Billboard Hot 100 with the songs I Want You Back, ABC, The Love You Save, and I'll Be There.
Mm-hmm.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
Four singles, first four singles, all number one hits.
Yeah.
Crazy. Good stuff either way. Those are great songs. That's all I got for that too.
Yeah,
so.
I need to do a deep dive and find out who who the writers were and the studio musicians for the early Jackson 5 stuff.
It was, well, I mean, if it was Motown, it was the Funk Brothers.
Yeah. Really should have been. Anyway.
I'm just saying, like, I mean, like that's just how it was. But everybody knows about the Jackson 5.
Yeah.
Because they were, honestly, I mean, like, they were a family band, which was one thing, but they were also, like, you know, the boy band.
Yeah.
You know, because they were all young, and so they, you know, for the most part, they were all young. You know, but they had a wide variety of ages there, and so, I mean, it was like they really got the girls, because they had, like, the young girls all through the teenage girls, so. But Michael was obviously the star of the entire.
Come on, Jermaine.
I'm just saying, Michael was obviously the star. He was the best singer amongst them. So,
hey, I like some of Jermaine's solo stuff.
That is true. But
Dynamite.
Let's go ahead and move on from there.
All right, you a fan of Fifth Dimension, Brian?
Yeah. Why?
Because in 1968, both lead singers of Fifth Dimension married Marilyn McCoo and St. Louis's own Billy Davis Jr.
Really?
Yes.
Billy Davis Jr.?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So okay. So how did that play out?
Still both alive and married in their 70s.
Wow.
I believe Billy Davis is 79 and Marilyn is 73, 74, something
like that. Is he in St. Louis or does he live somewhere else?
I do not believe so. I think they've kind of retreated off to, like, the countryside somewhere in Tennessee.
Oh.
But they were doing music and making radio show appearances just a few years ago.
Ah.
You know?
Nice.
Yeah. But I, you know, of course, I think, like, most people would know the medley of Aquarius and Let the Sunshine In.
Yes. Which is... Which,
those are two separate songs, but the medley of them together became the radio hit.
Yeah. There's the sunshine.
Yeah. And however,
of course,
I think
famously used at the end of 40-Year-Old Virgin.
I've never seen it. So,
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Not for any particular reason. I just haven't seen it.
Mm. We'll have to remedy that one, I think.
I guess, but we're going to have to get a chorus line in first.
That's true. Well, we got a bunch of stuff we got to watch, because we got to watch Conan the Barbarian with Greg, and then we got to watch a chorus line, and now we got to watch a 40-Year-Old mm-hmm. Virgin.
I'm going to have Greg sit down just next to very powerful things to watch Conan the Barbarian.
Maybe in a couple weeks, you know, we can all come over to my place and
let's do it, yeah,
and watch it or something, or we can all go over to your place. I don't know, whichever.
Set up a weekend. Maybe I'll pull out one of those recipes that my mom used to bring snacks to kindergarten. Like, I'll pull out one of those, and you remember those snacks?
Yes, I do remember snacks.
My mom had the best snacks. That's how it went.
That is true.
Anyhow,
now I want to talk to your mom. So. Because
mm-hmm.
I haven't seen her in forever.
It's been a while. Yeah,
has been a long time. So, Let's see here. Do you want to take this next one or should I do it?
Go for it.
All right. 1977, Elvis Costello was arrested as he performed outside a CBS Records sales conference at the London Hilton Hotel. He was fined £5.
Outrageous.
How dare they? Such a vast amount. But that's it. That's a simple little stupid story that that was thrown in there. So. Right.
I don't know what the inflation rate was for 1977, but
well,
maybe
£5
is a whole lot more money.
Well, I mean, it still would. I mean, it's still. It's just
we don't need to look it up. It's fine.
Fiver,
we can. I mean, well, we can honestly move on.
Let's see. 1986. Peter Gabriel went to number one on the U.S. singles chart with "Sledgehammer," one of my favorite Peter Gabriel songs. And it was a number four hit on the UK charts. The song's music video won a number of awards, including a record 9 MTV awards at the 1987 MTV Video Music Awards. And it won the Best British Video at the 87 Brit Awards. And Gabriel was also nominated for 3 Grammys. As of 2011, Sledgehammer is the most played music video in the history of MTV, which is amazing.
Yes.
Because then that means that it outplayed Thriller.
Yes, yeah.
And
yeah.
Thriller was like played every hour, like at the exact same time in its entirety for like two,
right.
3 years in a row.
But Thriller is also like, you know, 17 minutes long.
That is true. That is true. So I remember seeing the Sledgehammer video, and I didn't even have MTV.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's how prevalent it was.
Funny story. When I was a kid, for a long time, I thought that that was a Talking Heads song.
Really?
Yeah. Don't know why, but I did.
Interesting. All right. You can take the last one if you want.
Ooh, here we go. 2002, Beyonce's film debut in Austin Powers. Foxy Cleopatra in Austin Powers in Goldmember opened in theaters, and she debuted. There you go. Beyonce movie, Mike Myers.
She did that in 2002?
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so 2002, it was her debut. I remember that, but I didn't remember that was actually her debut.
She was doing music before then.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, she was still famous before there. It's just that it was one of those things where people were just like, okay, we all know she's famous. This is Beyonce. Like,
yeah.
And this was really before she was like super known for like as the solo artist. And so, you know, she going into movies, and a lot of people were just like, really, you're gonna let the singer go in there and act?
Yeah.
And she actually did a pretty decent job. I mean, it was an Austin Powers movie, so it wasn't exactly like high art, but I mean, like the year after that, she did the Fighting Temptations, which was a great movie that
yes.
she was in.
And, yes.
And she's done a bunch of other stuff. She was in the movie Chess Records, where she played Ella Fitzgerald. And, yeah, I mean, she's gone on to
Wait,
do some,
the, Temptations movie, wasn't that called Dreamgirls?
No, The Fighting Temptations was a completely separate movie starring Cuba Gooding Jr.
Oh, I don't think I've ever heard of this.
Where his aunt lived down in some place in the South. I forgot where.
Okay.
And he had to go down there for the funeral. And part of the will was that he has to take the choir and lead them to or take them to whatever this championship
yeah.
thing is. And the choir is horrible. And so he has to go out and recruit other people. And he runs into Beyonce's character, and she's singing at a local club or something like that. And he has to convince her to come in and sing in the choir as his lead. And then he's got to go and recruit other people as well who might be pretty decent, of which those people include the OJs and Montel Jordan, you know, the famous high singer.
Yes.
Montel Jordan, not the host of the TV show.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of there's a lot of really good music in it, and a lot of good gospel music too. So, but. And Cuba Gooding Jr. is actually really, really good in that movie. So it's honestly one of my favorite sort of music-based films, you know? I don't really count it as a musical per se, but it's definitely in that vein of, It's a musical. So, but it's not. It's the music doesn't just come out of nowhere. You know, there's always the music. The music is coming as part of the plot. So, but yeah, it's not like a traditional kind of musical where music just comes out of nowhere. So, but that's all I got. And so she's done some good work as an actress, and then now she's become like the queen, apparently, to some people who worship her, and I don't get it, but whatever.
Yeah.
She posted pictures of her twins this last week, and apparently everyone went crazy.
Okay. Seriously. I am not that plugged into anyone's life that I don't talk to.
So there you go. But let's see, moving on, July 27th, we got 1958. This one, I think, is entirely fascinating. 1958, fans of rock and roll music were warned that tuning into music on the car radio could cost you more money. Researchers from the Esso Gas Company said that the rhythm of rock and roll could cause the driver to be foot heavy on the pedal, making them waste fuel.
Mm.
Rock and roll, bad for the environment.
That is coming from ExoGas, which became Exxon, Exxon Valdez, which is now Exxon Mobil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, those guys, yeah.
Yeah, well, the Exxon Valdez was a ship.
I got egg on my face.
The Exxon Valdez was a ship.
Yes, it was.
That caused, one of the largest oil spills in mankind's history.
Okay.
So there you go. But yes, Exxon, it's goofy, and I understand what they were saying, but at the same time, this was like one of the dumbest sort of studies that was done like back in the day in 1958, because they were just trying to find things to make rock and roll bad. Like, it can cause mania in children, and it makes them waste gas.
Yes, not unlike how a new genre of music called rap got attacked in the late 80s and early 90s, huh?
Yeah, but rap did actually cause, gas to be wasted, because on the West Coast, everybody had to have those classic cars, which were giant gas guzzlers. And therefore,
right, and that's
what caused
right,
it.
Because Coolio's Mystic Ride came out and everyone was like, damn economy.
I'm just saying, you've got the cruising down the street in my 6.4.
It has nothing to do with the fact that, the 1990 Chevy Cavalier was, the shittiest automobile to be released since the Yugo.
You know, it's not like they're, cruising down the street in my fuel economy Toyota Corolla.
Mm-hmm. My Nissan Leaf.
It's like,
Ghost ride the Leaf.
And even then, even in rap today, nobody's going to be cruising down the street in my Prius.
You're also not going to hear that from a Dave Grohl song. You're not going to hear that in a Foo Fighters song.
Well, that's because he wouldn't write about having a car.
Probably not.
But you would hear stuff in country music about driving trucks, which is just as bad. Therefore, once again, further proof that rap and country are nearly identical.
Can we move on to Mama Cass now?
Move on to Mama Cass!
1968, Mama Cass releases Dream, A Little Dream of Me.
I actually really appreciate Mama Cass.
She
was a fantastic singer.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. Releasing that album, though, that was a huge moment for her.
Yes.
So
I love how she sings that song live, because she takes every opportunity to just chew the scene and make the most of every possible opportunity to make, to just have melody. Anyway, there you go. That's musings on Dream World.
You are going to have to do this next one, though. I know that much.
Okay.
I don't know what this is.
You have no idea. All right. I'm so glad, because you're going to love this. So, 1973, a sound check for a music festival called Summer Jam at Watkins Glen turned into an impromptu concert as a few thousand people gather to watch bands do a sound check. The venue failed to hire any security for the day. The day before the festival started for the sound check, and so people just came in droves, and the bands kind of didn't give a crap. So everyone got to watch like 4-song mini sets of the band Allman Brothers and the Grateful Dead, just to name a few.
I'm looking this thing up. Hold on.
Okay, then. We always talk about impromptu concerts and free concerts and surprise shows on this and how much we appreciate them. And this just seemed to be like the great all-American story of people just taking advantage of an opportunity that was there and nobody caring.
Yeah. This is fascinating. I like this. Yeah. 1973 Rock Festival had the Guinness Book of World Records entry at the time for the largest audience at a pop festival. Estimated 600,000 fans came there. Wow. That's still amazing.
Mm-hmm. Watkins Glen is like a small town in New Hampshire?
New York.
New York. Okay.
Yeah. So that's why they were comparing it to Woodstock.
Mm, okay. Yeah.
And yeah. Let's see. Yeah, no, that's all good stuff. I like that. I'm going to have to check into that one actually a little bit more because I don't know anything really about that one. What do we got here? 1973, the New York Dolls' self-titled debut album goes out to the masses. Now, here's the great thing about the New York Dolls. As we both know, but not a lot of other people may know, the New York Dolls were actually the basis for pretty much what became punk music.
Yes.
And I mean, like, people will go, well, you know, what are the Sex Pistols in the UK, the Ramones in New York? Both of them said that they got their stuff from the New York Dolls. It's like, and if you go back and you look at the history of punk music, the New York Dolls were really the ones that really, like, kicked that genre into gear and got it to where it was later on. Now, there was some stuff before there, sort of like the proto-punk music, but it was honestly the New York Dolls that got everything rolling. So there you go.
Yes. If you want to know the real backstory and the history of punk rock, you should check out a video by the artist Jeffrey Lewis, who has about an 8-minute song comprising and medleying a whole bunch of different songs, taking you all the way from folk up until the Sex Pistols.
Yep. And that's kind of the funny thing is that, like, the proto versions of punk were actually had their roots in folk music, but then also combined it with like early rock and roll and just created this whole other thing.
Right.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's like,
well, you know, what happened is like the sort of, what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know.
The anti-establishment music
folk
had to change its tone when folk became pop.
Yes.
And that's where punk comes from. And it started in the U.S. And there you go.
Yes.
I said it.
It did start in the U.S. I don't care
Jeffrey
what the
Lewis,
British
go
people
look
say.
It up.
Yeah, I've seen that video before.
Yes.
It's fascinating. And and like just the fact that the dude remembers all of that stuff. It's great.
And
great,
I like Jeffrey Lewis as an artist, too. You should totally go check him out.
Some of his other ones that he's done, he did like the History of China.
Yeah.
Which was hilarious. Oh, man. That's good stuff. All right. So let's move on. 1976.
Here we go. Tina Turner files for divorce from her husband, Ike Turner, after 16 years of a very tumultuous, what some would call marriage, others might call abuse.
Yes. So now here's kind of the funny thing with Tina Turner is that if you talk to anybody in St. Louis, they love Tina Turner.
Yes.
Now, the problem is that Tina Turner doesn't really seem to love St. Louis back. But
I can't imagine why.
But we claim her because she came from East St. Louis and, you know, like just came out of this area. And so everybody likes to really claim her, although she honestly doesn't seem to really do much about or doesn't really care about St. Louis. So. It's like, it's kind of a one-sided relationship. But we here in St. Louis like to claim people for the slightest connection to our city if we can. So, it's like, this one person, they spent a month here once.
right.
They're from St. Louis, woo!
Right. Like John Goodman.
Well, John Goodman was from the East Side.
Yeah. Anyway. Right?
Well, I mean, he was from the Illinois side, I thought.
No.
Well, now I've got to look this one. But he actually still comes back to St. Louis and does stuff all the time. So he's John Goodman. Let's see. He was born in Afton, Missouri.
Okay.
And he was raised like in the...
That's practically St. Louis.
Yeah. I mean, that's not too far from where we are at all, but... went to Afton High School, and actually I know some people who went to high school with him. So, you know, there you go. Afton, Missouri. Then he went to Southwest Missouri State University in Springfield, Missouri. That's where he... There you go.
Okay, then.
Boom. Went on a football scholarship.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's all we got for John Goodman. Next. Let's see. We got 1983, Madonna's debut album gets a very rocky release as critics hated her. The Rolling Stones article called her vocals irritating as hell.
So,
way to be polite, Rolling Stone.
Well, come on.
So I've never liked Madonna's voice.
Really?
But at the same time, I can appreciate what she did in the 80s.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some of the stuff that she's done in the 90s as well. I actually thought the song Beautiful Stranger was a pretty decent song. But back in the earlier days, you know, like when she released like Holiday and stuff like that, it was mainly because she was really utilizing the visual format.
Mm-hmm.
And so it didn't necessarily matter that her voice wasn't the best because she had like that look that everybody was looking for and she was a good dancer.
Yeah.
And so, and she produced music videos that people were watching. And so that was why I can appreciate what she did for the art form. But at the same time, I'm not going to buy her albums. I'm not going to really listen to them, but I can still respect her. So,
hey, I've heard you belt out Like a Prayer.
Actually, no, I don't sing that one.
Yeah, you do.
I don't even, how does it even go? I don't even remember.
Just like a prayer. Ooh, I want to take you there. I don't know.
I know Papa don't preach.
Yeah, you do.
Papa don't preach. But, I mean, like, there are a couple of songs that I obviously remember. But the worst part is, of the Madonna songs that I do know, I know the Weird Al Yankovic versions more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like a surgeon.
Mm-hmm. Barely made it through med school. Somehow I made it through.
Complications have set in. Don't know how long.
Like a surgeon. Hey! Cutting for
the video for Like a Surgeon is amazing.
Yes.
Okay, Weird Al knows how to clown.
Yes.
That's just all there is to it. He went all out, didn't leave anything.
Left nothing
on the table.
Yep. All right, what else we got here?
Ooh, 1986, Nancy Wilson of Heart marries Cameron Crowe. Wait, that happened?
Seriously?
Yes.
She married Cameron Crowe?
Yes, she was married to Cameron Crowe up until like 2000.
The director?
Yeah.
It's like, who made all of those really great music-based movies?
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Cameron Crowe recently did a TV show. Only lasted one season and then got canceled, but it was called Roadies.
Okay.
And it was actually kind of an interesting TV show because it followed this group of people who were roadies for a band, and the band was fake.
Okay.
So that way they could have like actors or whatever like there on set all the time. But a reoccurring joke throughout the entire series was that the openers never lasted for more than one show. And so instead of having like another band on tour with them, everybody kept leaving for whatever reason happened to be there. But like on the second or third episode, they were supposed to have like Lindsey Buckingham shows up and like does a set, you know, it's like, and then like Halsey shows up at some point, I think. And like a bunch of other people show up to open for the other band.
Yeah.
It was like, but they hardly ever play songs from the actual band that like they're touring with. It's like, and I always thought that was just kind of funny. It's like, hey, let's bring in all these other artists, have them play their music, but not play any of the music of an actual, like, of the actual band who's the main, like, part of the show. But I don't know. I need to actually watch that series because I've heard it was okay, but I wouldn't mind seeing it just because it's music related. So, but there you go. That's just weird that Nancy Wilson married Cameron Crowe.
Yeah, I that was new information to me when I found that.
All right, so I got the next two. I know this for a fact. All right?
All right,
here we go.
You can have it.
1991, the great Canadian himself, Bryan Adams, started a 7-week run at number one on the U.S. singles chart with "Everything I Do, I Do It For You," which is one of the sappiest love songs ever written.
Yes, God, that song was everywhere, and I hated it every time it came on.
Because, of course, it was also used in the Robin Hood Prince of Thieves soundtrack, which was great. But even to this day, Robin Hood Prince of Thieves is like my favorite Robin Hood movie.
Yeah,
even
here's though
it's
the thing
like,
about
it's
that.
Not good.
Yeah, I love that it was on the soundtrack, but not in the movie. It was just used to promote the movie.
Well, it was used for like the closing credits.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I guess technically it's in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just saying it. But it was, and then like all the music videos that they did, or the music video that they did featured clips from the movie. But I thought that was great. When I was actually in Canada, though, there were a ton of commercials for Bryan Adams, and it just cracked me up because I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot. He's Canadian and they like worship him here. So. let's see, 1991, though, Jesus Jones went to number two on the U.S. singles chart. So the exact same day, Jesus Jones hits number two with the song Right Here, Right Now. Right here, right now. You not remember that
I one? Don't remember that one.
You don't remember Right Here, Right Now?
Watching
the world wake up from history.
No. When you say Right Here, Right Now, I think of the Van Halen song. Hey, it's your tomorrow.
Right now?
Right now. Come on. It's everything. Yeah.
Wow. No. So, yeah, Jones, Right Here, Right Now. It hit number two, and it was unable to move Bryan Adams' Everything I Do It For You off of the 7-week run that it had. And so I don't know why. I just thought that was kind of a funny little tidbit that was thrown in there. It's like, you know, here's who was at number one and at number two who failed to knock him out. It's like, you know, what was it? An old SNL joke that I remember. It was like from the Weekend Update. It was like, you know, it's like, and currently at number one on the U.S. singles chart is Better Than Ezra. And at number two, of course, you guessed it. Ezra.
Such a shit joke, but I love it.
So poor Jesus Jones never knocked out the Bryan Adams. Mm-hmm. But, you know, whatever it is, what it is. It's ancient history as far as music is concerned.
You know what's ancient history?
Go to the next one. July 28th. What do you got?
1750.
Yes.
Johann Sebastian Bach dies at age 65.
Now, I do love some Bach.
Do you now?
Yes.
Minuet in E minor.
So I've always, because the reason why I like Bach was because his music was so complex. Yeah. It was awesome. Just some of the things that he put together, just mind boggling on how his mind worked. Like Mozart and the rest of them, they were trying to put together like this sort of really nice listening music. Beethoven was trying to put together like sort of nice listening music.
Right. Scarlatti was composing things that his cat had stepped onto his, you know.
Yes. But Bach was just like, screw that. I'm going to make the most complicated stuff I can. And so that's exactly what he did. It's good stuff. But yes, a sad day in music history. The death of Johann Sebastian Bach. So moving on. Up from there, though, we have a birth.
We do have a birthday.
So you're going to have to do this one because I honestly don't know who this is.
You don't know who this is?
No.
Well, 1915, Frankie Yankovic is born in Davis, West Virginia.
Now, is this like Al's father?
No. No relation to Alvin Yankovic.
No direct relationship that we... But, I mean, obviously, there's some family relationship. It's just that...
If you say so, I don't know what Yankovic means in Yugoslavian.
Yeah, but, I mean...
Well, I mean, it could mean Taylor.
Considering the size, I mean, like, there's got to be something, though.
Maybe if you go back long enough, but Weird Al says no. It's just a coincidence. coincidence that one of the greatest accordion players of all time, Frankie Yankovic, has the same last name.
Yep.
So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to talk about that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because that guy can play the Pennsylvania polka like nobody.
The Pennsylvania polka.
Anyhow, let's just keep going.
I love that song, actually. That's a great little polka.
I was singing that one day, and like just for whatever reason, and my dad heard it, and he goes, "What are you singing?" I'm like, "I'm singing the Pennsylvania polka." He's like, "I thought that the lyric to that song was, 'This is the greatest polka.'"
So you want to know the entire reason as to why I even know that song exists?
Groundhog's Day.
Groundhog's Day.
There you go. Because you hear it like 40 times.
40 times.
Anyhow, 1933, the very first singing telegram is sent to Rudy Valley for his 32nd birthday.
Really? Sent to Rudy Valley?
Rudy Valley.
Wow. Never would have guessed that one.
Why don't you tell the folks who Rudy Valley was?
Rudy Valley was... crap, you're going to make me actually...
No, I'll bail you out on this
Go
one.
Ahead.
Rudy Valley was a singer, of course. And he was kind of like one of the first like teen idols, because did you know that teenagers were invented in the 20s by magazines?
Mm-hmm.
Up until then, teenage was not really even an English word.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, this guy.
Yep, he was a band leader, singer, teen pop icon. And hey, there you go. He got the very first singing telegram.
Wow, that's kind of amazing, actually. I wonder how much it cost.
I don't know. I don't know when they stopped doing them either.
Yeah.
Like if there are still singing telegram services out there, don't let me know, because I'm never going to pay for that.
But, let's see here, though.
These next two I put in just for you.
All right. So 1939, Judy Garland records Over the Rainbow, and the world is never the same.
Really?
That song has an enduring quality and an endearing quality that people still just love to this day. But her version of it, in my opinion, is still the best. Although the one Hawaiian dude's ukulele version is like a close second.
Okay.
So there you go. But moving on up, just a couple more years, on the exact same day in 1941, Judy Garland marries David Rose. He was a composer.
Mm-hmm. You might know him from Calypso Melody or the theme from Bonanza.
Hey, do you like the theme song from Bonanza? No, that's his. They ended up splitting in 1944, so they didn't last very long. But of course, Judy Garland's most famous relationship was her marriage to Mr. Minnelli, Liza's father.
Ah, yeah. Oh, yes.
Now, Minnelli was a director, and he actually directed Judy Garland in her famous role in, Meet Me in St. Louis.
Ah, yeah.
I don't know why that for some reason I was thinking the song, like, ding, ding, ding with the trolley.
Yes.
Because that song was on there. So, like, ding, ding, ding with the trolley. So, he directed her in that. And if you actually look back and you see that movie, you can really tell that he loved her.
Yeah.
Because of just the way he shot her in that movie. Yeah. It is evident in the way that he made that film around her. So there you go. Judy Garland records Over the Rainbow, and then a couple years later married David Rose. And there you go. But this next one, however... this is one of mine that I put in here for our show notes.
Yes, I love the story.
1969. This is fan-frickin-tastic. And just to show you exactly how the world works in weird ways, the police in Moscow reported that thousands of public phone booths had been vandalized after thieves were stealing parts of phones to convert their acoustic guitars to electric. A feature in a Russian youth magazine had shown details on how to do this. That's great.
Yeah, it's great. It's like the anarchist cookbook for guitars.
Yeah. It's like, here, you can steal parts from a phone booth and learn how to actually make an electric guitar.
That's like, great, man. I guess they were pulling out the receiver and, dude, that's, hey, if anyone in St. Louis has a Moscow converted electric guitar and you have pictures of it, send them my way.
Nice. All right, you can do the next one.
Ooh, okay, yeah, this is great. This is my pick. This is what I brought this week.
This is your weird story of the week?
This is my weird story of the week. 1987, Ozzy Osbourne plays Jailhouse Rock at the end of a set in Wormwood Scrubs Prison, London. The rough and tumble audience is mostly convicted murderers, and they storm the stage and sing, jump, dance with the band for 15 or so minutes, with the band fearing what would happen if the music ended. Ozzy Osbourne smiled through the whole thing and later said that it was his last good memory of the 80s.
Wow. That's great. Oh, man.
Yeah. Now, here's my question, right? Where the hell is the Ozzy Osbourne Folsom Prison Blues album? I want to hear that. Yeah. Why was that not recorded? It would have been amazing.
That is true. Ozzy Osbourne playing at a prison.
Prison live? Come on.
That would have been great.
Ugh, crazy. Come on. Crazy train.
Yep. All right, what else? We got something else here?
Yes, we do. Also in 1987, Ice-T's releases the album Rhyme Pays, and it is possibly the first album with a voluntary warning label, a parental advisory sticker. At least that's what Ice-T says. That's been called into question, and people have pointed out a couple things, but if nothing else, it's definitely the first hip-hop album with a voluntary parental advisory sticker on it.
Yeah.
So there you go, 87 to 1993, 6 years before people quit playing and just stood naked on stage. That's a reference to last week's show.
Yes.
Okay.
So I can close out the show for this week. So 1992, Prince actually trademarks the male-female symbol found plastered Warhol style on album covers and promo material as when he became like basically the artist formerly known as Prince. And we've talked about that before.
Yes.
Due to some stuff with the label, being able to use his name and promote stuff. And so he was just like, screw you guys, I won't perform under that name anymore. And then just to mess with you even more, I'm going to perform as a symbol.
Well, this is a couple of years before the official name change, but still.
So, yes, but it's one of those things where, like, Prince was just thinking way outside the box.
Yeah.
It's just great. That's fantastic. Prince was like in his own world, and it was Prince world where I can have weird symbols.
Right, and record on the John.
Yes, because every room was rigged for recording sound. Boom. Well, that brings us to the end of the show. I hope you enjoyed it. We had a fun time doing this episode. If you want to, of course, listen to some other podcasts, because why not? If you like ours, you might like some other ones too. You can go to lineupmedia.fm and check out all of the other great programming that we have on there, including one of my other favorite podcasts, which is This Day in History. So if you like our music history and you want more general history, you can go find that on This Day in History. And they produce a podcast every single weekday. For the most part, occasionally they have to skip a day or two or something like that if something pops up. But for the most part, they hit one out every day, and it's some good stuff.
Man, a podcast a day is a tall order.
And they do an hour every day, at least. Mm-hmm.
The only other show that I know that does that is Distorted View, and they do 5 days a week.
Yeah. So, I believe starting shortly is going to be a new podcast on the network called Grab Your Popcorn, which I am hoping to be a part of or a regular reoccurring guest on the show. And I'm looking forward to helping out Blake Bamper get that one set up.
That's sounds like innuendo. I'm just going to say.
Grab your popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. That's what I told him. I said it almost sounded dirty. So,
yeah.
At least it doesn't say grab my popcorn. Ooh, that would have been even better.
That's better. Right now, name change. We're doing it.
No. I can't make them change. But also, if you want to help out the show financially speaking, you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com and click on the Amazon banner. Or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon to take you to the exact same place as the banner. And From there, you can go to Amazon and do all of your normal shopping. Just buy some stuff that you need, because let's face it, you can find almost anything on Amazon and they ship it to you. And if you're a Prime member, it's even better, because then it's like, you know, you get like 2-day free shipping and stuff. But if you buy everything there, you know, we get a little bit of money back, a percentage of whatever it is that you buy. And it helps us continue to do the show, and it makes me look good to my boss, who's like, yeah, they're bringing money in. Woo! But yeah, just go to the website and click on the Amazon banner, or go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. And Jake, I think that'll close us out. This has been Follow the Sound. I have been your host, Brian Kroc, and along with me has been my co-host and confidant and friend, comrade, and a couple more things that I could throw in there, Jacob Crum.
In the midnight hour, I can feel your power, just like a little prayer. You know I'll take you there.
Remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.